This is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Hey, welcome to Bob, Dave, and Moore. It's Dave Wyman, Jim Moore. We got Maura Dooley, of course, our producer, DJ on the board, and then Bob Stelton on vacation. So we went to the bullpen and got, is it the crafty righty, would you be, Michael Bumpus, or are you more of a fireballer? How would you categorize yourself?
I like the crafty. Bullpen? I like the crafty. Crafty. You know, I got... Sounds like I got more tricks up my sleeve when you say crafty. You know? I'll go with crafty.
That's right. You're the seasoned veteran. So good to have you with us, Bump. And hey, today on the show, we got Ryan Divish coming up at 3:30 and John Clayton, of course, at 4 o'clock. We're giving away to the Mariners, who actually pretty surprising. Pre-game show at 5 o'clock and a 6:10 first pitch against the A's. It's their final game against the A's in this 10-game homestand, which includes, I guess, the Angels coming to town and also the Rockies. But we'll see if they can even the series with the A's tonight. And before we get started, I want to mention a guy that's been on our show, guys, and this is really sad news. Howard Mudd, who's an offensive line coach. And, you know, it's funny, Sam Atkins is the one who introduced me to him. And so we had him on the show maybe, what, 3 months ago, Jim, something like that? And
yeah, I think
he talked,
right.
He talked offensive line. But him and I spent like an hour on the phone, just had a lot in common. We lived in the same frat house. He went to Michigan State. Guy was a seven-year veteran in the NFL and a three-time Pro Bowler. And just a really good football coach. He got a really bad motorcycle accident over the weekend. So he's in surgery, and they're trying to get his pelvis and his spine back together. So if you have any good thoughts or prayers out there for Howard Mudd, one of the really good guys in the NFL and coached for a long time. I was looking at some of his stats, and while he was in Indianapolis, they had the least sacks in the NFL in his 12 years with the Colts, and he coached all over the place, coached here in Seattle, and coached Big Ray Roberts, and Ray tweeted out this weekend, "I've been in touch with the family. Please pray for my all-time favorite coach and a great man. Love you, coach. Prayed up." So from Ray Roberts, and I know Brock Heward knows him really well, and Sam Atkins, so just send all your good thoughts and prayers to Howard Mudd, who's, I guess he's at Harborview Medical, and pretty serious accident over the weekend, so our best thoughts to him. So, you know, I can't get enough of Jamal Adams, and Pete Carroll was talking about him over the weekend, and he had a couple of clips here, and one of the things, and this is interesting, you know, Pete talked about Jamal Adams' style, because everybody's trying to figure out how are they going to use Jamal Adams, you know, is he going to be almost like a linebacker? He seems like a guy that can play all over the field to me, but in cut number one, who would know better than Pete Carroll?
One of the things, the style of his play is that he's really aggressive. He's an attack-oriented guy. He's a guy, the kind of guys that I've seen in years past, that when they see things, they don't hesitate. They go. And they're very, very decisive and very physical and creative as well. It takes creativity to see the opportunities and then to seize those opportunities. And he's got all of that. Great burst, physical nature, and then also the athleticism to make the plays happen. He's really good in coverage one-on-ones. He's good in zone stuff. So it just all fits.
Yeah, and you know, he said there, Jim, he's good in zone stuff, and that's the one thing where I know you noted he's been up in the box quite a bit, and we don't see him, you know, dropping into zone. Like if you look at his highlights, it's a lot of man-to-man coverage, but he's good at that stuff. And it was good for me to hear that from Pete anyway, that that he knows how to play zone, because they want to play, you know, cover three, and they want to, you know, kind of keep things in front of him, but also they can play man-to-man with him. It just sounds like his versatility, he fits right in.
Well, yeah, I was just looking. Yeah, the Seahawks are known. They love to have guys who are versatile along the offensive line, defensive line. Now we're seeing this in the secondary with Jamal Adams. I was reading Bob Condotta's story in the Seattle Times this morning, and he was noting from DallasNews.com, they had all the snaps. He's not a true strong safety in the sense of the word there. When you look at everything that he does, he didn't even play half of the snaps for the Jets last year at that position, just 43%. He was 28% at free safety, so you've got some options there with Diggs. Although the thing is that I like Diggs at free safety. We know what he did once he got here, those five games, and that's one of the reasons you think the Seahawks will be improved. Even before Jamal Adams came over here, was Diggs for 16 games. If you figure if he can do what he did in five games, then you take that over 16, it's certainly going to help. But Adams is a guy, I mean, you just look, he's all over the field. 14.5 snap of his snaps last year, he was in the slot. 11% on the line of scrimmage, and then 3.5% at cornerback. So it's going to be fun. It's a nice chess piece for Pete Carroll and Ken Norton to tinker around with this year.
Yeah, and Bump, you know, I said, Danny gave me a hard time for this, that him and Diggs play so purposefully. And I guess what I meant for that, Danny's giving me a hard time, like I'm trying to use a $25 word or something. But you know, they just, and Pete mentioned it there, he's just on a straight line. Like he's one of those few players like Earl Thomas. I call him like guided missiles. And that's really what I see out of him and how aggressive he is, as Pete said. What have been your observations when you look at Jamal Harris?
You know, he's one of those guys where you watch film and you always look for guys that jump off on the film, right? And I see him being super active, whether he's dropping into a zone, whether he's walking up inside the box, and his motor, you know, another phrase, right? There's all these cliches, all these phrases that you look for in a football player, especially on defense, and he has a lot of that. I like the motor that he plays with. I like how he's confident inside the box. And when he tackles somebody, Dave, I think I mentioned this last week, maybe on the Danny Gallant show. I was like, I'm sure Dave appreciates this. When he tackles somebody, he hits you. He's not trying to wrap you up. He's not trying to lay you down on the turf. He's trying to knock you out. And I compared his film with McDougal, who I think was a very good player for this team. And I looked at the same blitz. They both walk down. They're about to blitz off the edge. And they get to the quarterback. It almost looked like the exact same play. But when McDougal hit the quarterback, it's kind of like he just wrapped him up. When Adams hit the quarterback, I mean, the quarterback, his head jerked back, and it was just violent, you know. And that's the type of guy you want roaming around that field on defense. He's the type of guy that guys worry about. That guys, you find out where 33 is because he's going to come down and try to smack you. And Pete Carroll said, Jamal's dynamic when aggressive. So now, are you going to let him be dynamic? Are you going to be aggressive with this new personnel that you have out there? So I love what I saw on film. The guy's active. Motor's going. He's going to run you down from the other side of the field. He's just exactly what I feel like this defense needed on the back end.
Well, Bump, do you feel like they're going to let him just be versatile and let him just roam all over the field? Or it sounds like maybe you might have a doubt or two about that.
I do have a doubt because that's not what they like to do. You know, if you look at this defense last year, they like to play soft zone and keep everything in front of them. And maybe they did that because of the personnel. But now you have a Quandre Diggs back there. Now you have Jamal Adams. So I hope that they do. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. I would be a little disappointed if they didn't. But there's no way they look at that film and say, okay, we're going to drop this guy into his zone every single play. We're not going to man him up. We're not going to blitz him. This guy had 10 tackles for loss, 6.5 sacks. Use it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I don't think that they're going to change their defense too much, you know, but they'll be able to, you know, do some different things. Like Pete says, we'll be able to do more cool stuff is what Pete likes to say sometimes. But yeah. And then, you know, he actually compared him to, in cut number two, he's talking about how Diggs and Adams could highlight each other, kind of like Cam and Earl did.
You know, we had a very dynamic duo in years past, you know, when Cam and Earl were here. Those guys were entirely different players. I mean, they couldn't have been further. I mean, one guy was huge, the other guy's a smaller guy. Just a huge difference in the talent that they brought. But yet we incorporated their stuff to hopefully, we tried to, it was the illustration of our approach to highlight the uniqueness of the players. And so that's what's going to happen here with Jamal and really Quandre Diggs is a really dynamic player too. He showed that last year with us. And as we already pointed out, Marquise has a whole structure to his game that we love to fit in. So this is really all we could hope for. And you know, you'll see it come to life.
But you know, you got three guys that what I was saying at the end of last year, Bump, is that they need a hammer on defense. They need a Cam Chancellor. I mean, you go back to Super Bowl 48. I think the play of that game was Cam hitting that crosser, the receiver. I mean, yeah, that just sent a message and a tone. And that's the thing. And what you mentioned was he doesn't want to just tackle guys. He wants to smoke them. And that's kind of what you saw to Quandre Diggs as well. Not kind of, actually a couple of times he was coming up trying to take people's heads off. And so, yeah, I mean, and when you have a guy back there, I mean, you think people coming in, offensive players, receivers, didn't know where Cam Chancellor was? I mean, if you can get that kind of intimidation factor going in your defensive backfield, all of a sudden, you know, this looks like a totally different defense with those two guys roaming around back there.
Yeah, when you have a Cam Chancellor-like guy, when you have a guy who can kind of freelance, the scary thing about safeties are that they're the last line of defense, but they almost see everything. You know, it's all developing in front of them, so they can anticipate a crossing route. They can anticipate a post or an out. And when you're a receiver and you know there's a guy back there who isn't afraid, who's bigger than you, who's stronger, who's going to come downhill and try to light you up, you're going to think twice about it. Now, these are professionals. They should still attack the football and try to come down with it. But you mentioned it, Dave. I believe that hit that Cam had in the Super Bowl was what, like the third play of the game or something like that. You know, it was so early in the game that you're right. He set the tone. And that's what I feel like great defenses always have that type of player on it. And I feel like the Seahawks finally have that type of player who's going to come out and set the tone. Honestly, Dave, it could be on a bust play, a scramble play, and a receiver doesn't keep his head on the swivel. And, you know, he's not paying attention. He gives him a little nudge. So it's more than just making the play on the ball. It's how he affects the route running of receivers as well who aren't even getting the ball.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, Michael. I was thinking about it, and then Schneider was talking about it, too, in the NFC West, all the different receivers coming across the middle. You added Hopkins down there in Arizona. You got Kittle in San Francisco. You still have Larry Fitzgerald in Arizona. The Rams with Cooper Kupp. And so I would think, and you played receiver there at WSU and for the Seahawks, and I would think that you have second thoughts when you go across the middle when you know there's a guy like Jamal Adams there.
Oh, most definitely. You guys remember Darnell Bing, USC safety. He was big coming out of Cali at, I believe, he went to Long Beach Poly, and you knew where he was every single down. You know, especially as receivers, you find the safeties anyway to kind of ID the coverage, but you knew where he was. That's what Jamal Adams is going to do.
Yeah, well, and he doesn't have like the size intimidation factors that Cam does, but I always say, you know, low man wins, and you know that guy. You look at guys like Bob Sanders. I mean, you know, they're low to the ground and explosive. But and Pete didn't really have anything new on Quentin Dunbar's status. But in cut number four, you know, he talked about the cornerbacks now, and it's just interesting how all of a sudden when you get Jamal Adams here and you think, oh yeah, Quandre Diggs played really well. Oh yeah, Shaquille Griffin was actually a pro bowler who, you know, he was an alternate. And all of a sudden, especially if you put Dunbar in there, in cut number four, Pete talks about how he feels about the cornerbacks.
We're in the developmental stage of our corners' growth, you know. I thought Shaq had a great season last year for us, really bounced back. I thought year one and year two was there. We thought he could do better. Year three, he I thought he did a fantastic job. I thought he exploded. A playmaking, physical, count on, come through guy, all of that, big plays, all of that stuff he did. In year two for Trey, I thought also kind of maybe not as much ground we made up as I would have liked. So he comes back for us just with a whole another experience in his back pocket. I'm going to expect him to be, and as a matter of fact, I'd already have talked to him about this, be very aggressive. Very physical, and make sure that we take advantage of the 2 years that he's got behind him now, and it really comes to the front.
Yeah, something weird happened going into the last game last year. I was filling out my board that I have, like a spotting board. It's got big blocks on it, and you write different things about different players. And for Shaquille, I wrote down, has three interceptions this year. And then I was like, what games were they in? And then I went back and I was like, oh, he didn't have any interceptions. Why did I write that? I was convinced that he had three interceptions. I know he did have one that got called back because of a holding penalty. Yeah, and that was on Jamar Taylor, I believe. Hate to beat him up, but man, yeah, that did not work out. But, you know, as far as just how he played, I know, Jim, you're big on interceptions, which you should be, and he didn't get an interception last year. It's been a long time since he's gotten one, but he seemed to play really well. And then Trey Flowers, he talked about, you know, just being, to me, he was, the biggest problem with him was that he just didn't trust himself. He was grabbing too much, and I didn't see him get beat real badly. It's just that he had those penalties, and that's one thing I think he needs to work on. And remember, we talked to him before the season last year, Jim, and you had brought up to him that, you know, I don't know who it was, Florio or somebody had him rated as like the second most improved corner. And he looked all of us right in the eye and said, guys, I really don't care about that stuff. I appreciate you bringing it up, but I really could care less about that because really I hold myself to my own standards. So as a kid, very conscientious about his play. And I think that's one of the reasons why he is kind of a grabber at the end, that he just wants to do it right, you know, and not get beat so badly that, you know, that was just kind of his reaction. So it seems like something to me anyway, that he should be able to overcome.
Yeah. You know, when I think about Trey Flowers, I always think about what you said about him last year, Dave, that he really wasn't, it seemed like everybody was trashing on the kid because of the playoffs and difficulties he had, some penalties, some grabbing penalties and that type of thing. But you know, it's encouraging to hear. And I think, Bump, I think you said that Flowers maybe wasn't as bad as everybody thought he was either. But with even that being said, though, you think about Dunbar down in Florida. You're hoping, you know, it's going to be an upgrade if he's allowed to play for the Seahawks this year. Because if you get Dunbar, then you're starting to talk about a back four there that is maybe not in the same sentence as the Legion of Boom, but you can start making legit comparisons to the Legion of Boom if you added Dunbar back there with Shaquille Griffin. And the metrics and Pete Carroll, what he had to say about Shaquille Griffin, they're all pretty much complimentary of how he's been doing. And yeah, I just feel like if you're a starting left corner in the NFL, you should have more than zero interceptions if you call it a good season. And he hasn't had an interception since he had two against Cleveland in game two of the 2018 season. So it's a big season really for Shaquille Griffin, because he's entering the last year of his contract and he's sitting on the doorstep of a $14 or $15 million payday if he can just make some more plays out there in left corner.
Yeah, Shaq's got to make some plays. He's just got to turn the ball over. I feel like he's normally in good position. He's normally on the receiver's hip. He's a fast guy, and he can kind of take chances because he's the fast guy. But on defense, it's all about causing turnovers, right? And the Seahawks did a decent job at causing turnovers last year, but you want to see your corners with picks. When K.J. Wright has more picks than you do, and you're a corner, and it raises some concerns, right? K.J. Wright has covered running backs out in space. He's put himself in positions to make plays, and I feel like Shaq has as well. It's all about finishing it up now. And you know how it is, Jim. Sometimes, man, you get that contract year, guys do things they haven't done their whole careers. So maybe he'll be motivated. I don't think he's not working hard. I don't think he's not a hard worker, but it's just different when there's money on the line. Maybe he takes more chances. Maybe he's more aggressive attacking the ball out the air. I don't know. He knows he doesn't have any picks, any interceptions. So let's see what he does. Let's see how he responds. Let's see if he plays a little more aggressive when the ball's in the air.
Yeah, maybe that's one of those human nature things. I don't ever remember thinking anything other than every year was like a contract year for me. You know, I guess when my contract was up, maybe I played a little bit harder. I don't know. But yeah, it'll be interesting.
I don't think that was the case with you, Dave.
I'm not much for the human nature side of it. But another guy, we've been talking a lot about Bump, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. But Pete Carroll talked a little bit in cut number five about ways to figure out how to use Marquise Blair.
For the most part, we have to figure out Marquise. He's the one that's going to get the opportunity to get in on the slot and do some stuff that puts him in a position to be really active and be part of the pressure packaging and some real aggressive part of the play.
He makes lots of plays. And quickly, Michael, before we get to take two, I'm just curious your take on him. I think he's probably the biggest question mark and also the most exciting question mark on this defense.
Yeah, I agree. What does he have, two or three forced fumbles? I mean, he's made some plays in limited time. It's not like he was a starter out there. And you feel him. And that's what you want out of especially defensive players. You want to feel their presence out there. And when Marquise Byrd was out there, we felt him. He's young. I think it's almost a blessing now that Jamal Adams is there so Blair isn't forced to be thrown into the fire. They can use him in the slot and play some nickel stuff. They can spell Adams or Quandre when they need to. Bring that guy along slowly. He gets to learn from Jamal Adams, who is one of the best safeties in the league, and Quandre Diggs, who is a top-tier safety. So now he has some mentors. McDougal was a good mentor, but when you replace him with a Pro Bowler, he's going to learn. I'm excited. Just put the guy in. I want to see him make some plays early or have him fail early. Even if he fails, he's still learning. So you can't repeat what they did last year and try to hide these young guys.
All right, let's take two.
It's time to take two. Brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
Take two.
Yesterday, a group of Pac-12 football players wrote a letter threatening to opt out of fall camp and games unless the league meets their demands on COVID-related safety protocols and economic and social issues.
Yeah, so it sounds like that there's players that are expressing. I was reading John Wilner's, and we'll talk a little bit more about this at 3:45 because I really want to get your take on it, Bump. But John Wilner of the Seattle Times said basically there's three types of players in this thing, players who express their solidarity through social media. And then there's people that want to opt out because of the COVID concerns. And then there's a third group, and unknown amount of players that will opt out if their demands are not met. And over the weekend, Nick Rolovich, the head coach for Washington State, made it clear to Cassidy Woods that it's okay if you're in number two, which is opt out because of COVID concerns, but not if you're opting out because your demands are not met. And I think he's the only coach that has said anything that we've heard from anyway.
Yeah, we'll see how that all shakes up. It seems like on the surface there's trouble brewing over there in Pullman, and I hope that Rolovich will have a comment about what's going on over there. I think he was taken out of context on that one. It made it seem like he wasn't on board with racial injustice and Black Lives Matter. And right. But I think what it was that he just wanted to lay out to Cassidy Woods that look, it's one thing if you opt out because of COVID, but its scholarship might be at risk here if you go the other way.
A lot of reality there, and a lot of reality that people don't really understand. And we'll get into it more, but yeah, I'm with you, Jim. His words were twisted up a little bit, but he's also being frank and being honest about that situation with the kid.
The St. Louis Cardinals four-game series with Detroit has been postponed as 13 members of the organization have tested positive for COVID.
Yeah, this is discouraging that, you know, because it was the Miami Marlins that had, what, 21 or something, I think, last we talked, Jim, on Friday. But now it looks like Cardinals, Detroit, I mean, this is, and look, a lot of them are, you know, like Doug Peterson, the head coach of the Eagles, they, you know, asymptomatic, but still it's discouraging when you start seeing those numbers climb up there, especially, you know, waiting for football to start here.
Well, it is. And then you think about the domino effect because you go back and you think, okay, who have the Cardinals played recently? And I think the Minnesota Twins, you know, they're probably concerned about. And then if their COVID numbers go up, then what do you do? Are the Twins going to cancel some games? I don't think we've heard anything about the Twins yet, but all these different things that are happening here. We haven't heard anything with the Mariners yet, so they've been good. But, yeah, baseball's just kind of hanging in the balance with we'll see if they can get through a season. And what are we now? We're 10 games into it, but still 50 to go.
Oh, man, this scares me. It scares me. I'm like, we're not going to have a football season. If baseball, if these guys are contracting the virus that easily and they can practice social distancing way better than you can on a football field in a facility, it's discouraging, but I guess we'll wait and see what happens.
Yeah, definitely is. Well, coming up next, we're going to talk to Ryan Divish and talk about the M's starting pitching a little bit. Maybe who's looking good in the bullpen. Well, from the Seattle Times, we'll talk to Ryan Divish. That's next on Bob, Dave, and More.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Hey, it's Bob David Moore, Dave Wyman, Jim Moore, and we got Michael Bumpus filling in today for Bob Stelton. And on the phone, we got Ryan Divish from the Seattle Times. Divish, did you have a good time at the ballpark this weekend?
That wasn't too bad. I mean, it's a little different, but it's not too bad. You know, you're going there. It's a little bit better than covering them off TV, I would think. You know, though there are benefits to covering them off TV, but it's just not the same. I don't mind going there at all.
Yeah, because you can lay around in your underwear is the benefit of watching it on TV. Hey, how excited are you about Kyle Lewis? 17 hits, leads the league, and read today the Mariners put out something. He's hit safely in each of his first 10 games. It's not been done since 2007 by a rookie, and joins Joey Cora, Andy Chavez, D. Gordon. Are you officially excited, or are you still waiting on Kyle Lewis?
Oh, I'm excited. I think the biggest thing for me being excited for Kyle is just that he's healthy. I mean, he's healthy enough now that they're out having him play center field on an almost daily basis. And that's partially because, you know, even a banged up or even Kyle Lewis, you know, and all the knee issues he's had in the past is still probably a better center fielder than Alex Smith. You know, I don't know if that's his position going forward, but he's handled it really well. But yeah, I think that's just the biggest thing, that he's healthy. He doesn't look like he's worried about his knee or anything like that. You know, it's been basically, you know, he played all of last year and made it through without any issues, and he comes into this year fully healthy, and you can kind of see the speed come back and all those things. So I think that's the biggest thing. And then maybe the other aspect that I think I've been most impressed with is just kind of his approach at the plate, particularly with two strikes. There's always kind of this concern that with his power and his ability to hit the ball the opposite field, he'd be a 30-home run type of guy. But that he also strike out 175 times a season. I think he's gotten better at understanding what pitches he can hit and having a better approach with two strikes and just kind of staying with what pitchers are giving him and not trying to do too much with everything, especially with two strikes. And I think that's been the most impressive of that is his strikeout numbers aren't the same as they normally have been, and his walk numbers are up as well.
Okay, Ryan, this is probably crazy because Taijuan Walker went 7 innings, gave up 1 hit, 8 strikeouts, 94 pitches. He was fantastic. And yet I thought Kikuchi was even better Saturday night. He looked like an ace. He was throwing 97. I mean, he just had hitters tied up all night long. 9 strikeouts, gave up 3 hits. I just thought he looked great.
Yeah, no, I did too. You know, he was throwing his kind of slider cutter thing at 91 miles an hour. He was aggressive. He worked fast, which, you know, sometimes last year when he'd get runners on, he'd turn into Miguel Batista and just stand there and stare blankly ahead and take forever. And just I wanted to throw my laptop out of the press box right at him for telling him to throw the ball. But, no, he had good rhythm, good pace. I think the biggest thing is, like, you know, he had a bad kind of – he didn't have a great outing against the Astros. I mean, he was throwing hard and everything. But it wasn't great. He didn't have great command. I think he had 4 or 5 walks. But the big thing was is he didn't change anything. You know, the stuff he worked on this offseason at Driveline and Kent and along with the Mariners pitching coaches is to simplify everything. And last year, he would have a bad outing like the one in Houston and then go and mess with his mechanics, change things up, try different things. Whereas this year, I think he just realizes this is what I should do. This is where I'm going to get the most best results. So I'm going to stay with these mechanics. And I thought that was the best aspect of it. But yeah, I thought he looked great. He was aggressive. He didn't try and nibble. Last year, he was really afraid of how much power major league lineups had. And he was just kind of, I thought he pitched afraid a lot last year. He didn't do that this year.
Hey, Ryan, going into the season, I thought Vogelbach, and I think a lot of people thought he had to really step up and produce, and he's been struggling so far. 6 games played, 17 at-bats, only 2 hits. What do you see now of this guy, and how do you think he kind of turns the corner?
Yeah, he hasn't been very good, to be perfectly honest. He's pretty much stunk since summer camp opened up. He looks heavier. I've been told he's 20-some pounds heavier. It doesn't look like he did a whole lot during the shutdown. In comparison to, like, Kyle Lewis, who was doing – he had a speed coach and was doing workouts every day. I don't know what Vogelbach was doing, but it doesn't look like he was working out. It doesn't look like he was hitting much. And, you know, there were a lot of questions coming around him this year. I mean, like, basically after about May 1st of last year, I think after May 15th, he hit about 160, you know. And so – I don't know. He doesn't have a position other than DH, which, you know, may help him. I think that DH will be universal going forward, but, you know, it doesn't hit lefties particularly well, and just they've kind of figured out how to pitch to him, and he hasn't done anything about it. I mean, I know some people think he'll be gone in a couple of weeks. I think they'll wait. You know, they don't have any reason to get rid of him now, and I don't know that Jose Marmolejos is an everyday big league player, but, you know, he's really, from what he did in the first 6 weeks of last season till now, I mean, there's a chance that they don't bring him back next year. There's a chance they release him this year if they were to have a roster tightening situation or something like that. But I just haven't seen anything that says it's going to get better. You know, they just kind of attack him under his hands. And he's so big, kind of across the chest and stomach area, and like core area, and his arms are kind of short that he just can't get the bat through. I had a scout text me last night or the other night asking about that, asking if he gained weight because they thought he did, and that he just looks really out of sync. So maybe they can try and fix something on him, but at this point, you know, the Mariners can just move forward. I mean, they don't necessarily need him. You know, they have a lot of young guys coming up, and you can certainly find a left-handed power guy that doesn't really do much else for you on the free agent market.
Speaking of guys that look like football players, Dan Altavilla, he's looked okay. Who's really gotten you? Well, I keep saying excited, and you don't really get excited, Divish. But who coming out of the pen are you liking right now? Altavilla's been okay.
He's been okay. I mean, like, he hasn't been great. You know, I think the homer he gave up off to Ohtani still might be going, but. He's been okay. I mean, honestly, I don't think they're both.
How about Johan?
At all.
How about Johan?
Oh, no, I don't like.
Come on. I love that kid.
Jim, it took him 47 pitches to get through two innings.
Yeah, but how many runs did he give? How many runs did he give up?
Well, it's because they were all afraid because they thought he was going to hit them every other time. No, he has a lot of talent, and I think there's something there. And they're having a chance to pitch him. He's a Rule 5 guy. He has moments where he impresses because he does throw 97 and he's got a nice slider. You can tell he's really raw and inexperienced. I thought Austin Adams was the most impressive reliever they had last year. So, there's a hope that he comes back here in the next week or two. So I'd be kind of excited to see how he pitches because I think he's pretty nasty. But, like, if you're Scott Servais right now and you're looking down to go into the bullpen and you have to go down there and it's essentially like, do I want to be punched in the face or kicked in the groin? I mean, that's what it feels like. I mean, because there's just no experience and they don't throw a ton of strikes and you just don't know what you're going to get and you can't pitch guys back-to-back yet. So, I mean, I would think that when Adams comes back, that'll be good. I'd be curious to see when some of the young guys like Joey Gerber and Sam Delaplane and some of the prospects, if they get a call-up this year, what they do. But, I mean, it's a rough bullpen. And for me, when you're writing a running game story, Jim, as you know, they start bringing in bullpen guys and it's close. I'm a fatalist. I'm thinking, yeah, the worst is going to happen. And I pretty much open up a new document and start a new lead for my story. And I haven't been doing that since Fernando Rodney used to be here.
Hey, we're up against the break here, Ryan, but just a quick update on Kendall Graveman and what his neck issue is.
Yeah, we haven't got any other updates about if he'll make his next start or not. It's just some kind of neck issue. I don't know if it's nerve or what that's bothered him a couple times throughout his career, and it affected him yesterday. His velocity is down a little bit. The Mariners hope that he'll make his next start. Graveman said he can't make it any worse by pitching, but he just doesn't feel comfortable at times. So they're going to hopefully figure something out, but if they hadn't figured anything out in the last couple years, I don't know that they will this time either. So it may be something he just has to pitch through for now.
Thanks, Divish. Go out there and get excited.
All right, I will.
Man. Appreciate you coming on.
I'm excited for the drive from Tacoma to Seattle. You know?
Yeah, there you go. Get fired up for it. All right, appreciate it, man. There he goes, Ryan Divish from the Seattle Times. Well, as we mentioned earlier, yesterday, a bunch of Pac-12 players banded together. They have some demands for the conference, and we'll talk about that next on Bob, Dave, and More.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Hey, it's Bob David Moore. We got Michael Bumpus filling in for Bob today. And, guys, yesterday a group of Pac-12 football players wrote a letter threatening to opt out of fall camp and games unless the league, the Pac-12, meets their demands on COVID-related safety protocols and some economic and social issues. And so, and a lot of those things are all over the place as far as a lot of different things. Medical insurance for 6 years after the college career is one of the things on the list of their demands. No waivers for signing COVID, you know, and saying that you won't come back if you do contract COVID-19, and then 2% to low income families. And I don't know if that's, it said black families or all families. So that, you know, so Nick Rolovich got himself kind of in trouble. So, you know, later in the day, he called Washington State wide receiver Cassidy Woods and, you know, basically told him, hey, if you're opting out for the medical part of it, the COVID-19 stuff, that's one thing. And then, but if you're joining this other group, with all the demands, I'm paraphrasing here, basically that's different. So, and, you know, I think he's the only coach that has done that. But, you know, it's an interesting situation. I guess I'm not surprised that this came up because there are some real concerns. But just trying to, you know, sort of rifle through this whole thing. John Wilner wrote an article at Seattle Times. And, you know, basically he had the players broken down into three groups. There are ones that are expressing solidarity on social media. Then there's ones that, some are opting out because of the COVID concerns. Like, I believe Cassidy Woods has sickle cell anemia diagnosis, so that was his reason. But then there are also players that are just opting out if their demands aren't met. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But I feel like Rolovich kind of, it seems like this is a bad look for him and a bad start at Wazoo. What do you two Cougars think?
Yeah, it's a bad look on the surface until you dig a little deeper. And it's hard to dig deeper right now because we haven't really heard from WSU. We haven't heard from Nick Rolovich. And so on the surface, it looks like, oh, okay, well, you can opt out for COVID-19 and we'll keep your scholarship. But if you're in the hashtag We Are United, the racial injustice part of it, then that's a different story. Then it makes him look racist almost. So I don't think right. That's the case, although, boy, he's had a lot of backlash, a lot of people talking about Nick Rolovich. Bomani Jones came out. He had some harsh words of criticism for him. I think Paul Feinbaum did too, but we'll see if that gets sorted out. I'm not just defending him because he's a Coug and, you know, he's at my alma mater or anything. I think there's more to that story that hasn't come out just yet.
Yeah, the crazy part is the kid like secretly recorded the message or the conversation, right?
Yeah.
And here's the reality about college football. They can take your scholarship whenever they want to. It's a year-by-year contract. It's not a four-year deal. You're not guaranteed to finish up there. I've seen guys have their scholarships taken away. And when I hear this, this is what I think. I think Rolovich is thinking, okay, look, if it has to do with your health, then I get it. But if not, I have to bring somebody else in to fill your spot because if we play, I still need players out on the field. That's where I think he was going with that. But because he hasn't said anything, the university hasn't said anything. Now we're allowed to speculate. It makes him sound like he's racist. Oh, I don't support the movement. I don't think Rolo doesn't support the movement. Everything that I've learned from him or I've met him a few times and seen the way he operates, I think he's all for that. I think that at the end of the day, he has a job. He's got to win football games. And if a player opts out because demands aren't met through the umbrella of the NCAA, then he has to find somebody else to take that job. Is that the right thing to do? It all depends on what side of the fence you're on. You could be like, oh, poor kid, you know, let him go through this and work it out and hold his scholarship. Or you can say, you know what, get him out there. He doesn't want to play. It's a tough situation for everyone involved because if you are with the movement and you want to sit down and you have these demands and you do this and change actually happens, then someone has to make the sacrifices for that change. Is it going to be the player? Is it going to be the coach? So it's just a tricky situation all around. I don't think Rolo is racist. I don't think he's against all that stuff. I think that he has a job, and his job is to win ball games. And if that kid isn't there, then I've seen guys get their scholarships pulled all the time.
Yeah, that's really well said, Michael. And that's the thing that I was going to ask you. But but for me, it was such a different time. I mean, like you said, now they're able to just pull scholarships, which, you know, of the top five recruits my year, I was the only one that had any meaningful playing time at Stanford of that recruiting class. One guy was just on scholarship for pretty much the whole time and didn't do anything. That's not the case anymore. So the question I would always ask is, was it a fair exchange? Absolutely, it was. Now, did the college football make a lot of money because of me and everything? Yes, but I got a free education and everything. But now it's changed a little bit. And that's the part that bothers me, that, you know, because I don't want the players to get paid and it to be this professional entity, because it will start to head that way. I think the allure of college football is the fact that these guys are all playing for their education and everything. And so, you know, that's what makes it cool. It's not a bunch of guys with agents out there trying to get as much money as they can. But, you know, now with, you know, the university side getting really cutthroat, I'm just yanking guys. I had a buddy who, he told me that there was a baseball team. He had a buddy that was on the coaching staff, and the head coach was telling guys on the plane ride home, yeah, you're done here. You know, you're off scholarship. Hmm. So, you know, there are, it's not the same as it used to be, but, you know, if this all of a sudden, you know, you start paying the players and giving them money and things like that, I feel like it will open up the floodgates for all kinds of things. Because look, Pac-12, you know, well, college football in general makes a lot of money, but, you know, and look, you know how much the commissioner gets paid and everything. And so whenever that comes up, then the kids are like, well, I just get a scholarship. I don't get any of that money. But to me, I still value a scholarship as being something. Like, I feel like it's a great setup too for the players. If you're auditioning for the NFL, all the, you know, training table and the trainers and the weight room and all that stuff. Yeah, I always felt like it was a fair exchange, but now I'm not so sure, just because of what you mentioned, Michael, that they can just yank scholarships whenever they feel like it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I loved my time at Washington State University. It was a privilege. I mean, I got an education there. I met my wife there. I've made a bunch of connections. I'm still in the state of Washington, and I'm from California, mainly because I went to Washington State University, and it gave me a kickstart to my life. It just gets funny, man, because there's so much money involved, you know, and they're making money off of these kids. They're printing jerseys with specific numbers on it. They're flashing their pictures on billboards and stuff. So it gets trickier. And then I guess these kids are just more aware of it, too. You know, I think when we were playing, we knew that they were making money off of us. But times have just changed, right? Times have changed. These kids are social media is big, so they can get their voice out and get heard. Like, we have these conversations in the locker room. I'm like, man, give me 5% of my jersey sales, and I'm rich in Pullman as a 20-something-year-old. My life changes. Those are the facts. And the facts are that when Alabama goes to a bowl game and Nick Saban hoists a trophy, he gets his $5 million. The SEC gets their money, but these kids don't get anything. They do get an education. It is a privilege to play football. But whenever money's involved, that's when things get tricky. And because they can just pull scholarships, that's what's messed up. Now, when kids sign on the dotted line, they should be there for 5 years guaranteed. They chose to go to that university. So take care of them. Give them some type of security. The fact that there's no security in that, it makes it a little shady to me.
Yeah, well, and you know, one of the things too, I would say it's a little bit the failing of the NFL in that they don't have, you know, any kind of like a farm system or whatever. And maybe that's something we can talk to the professor about next. Yeah. We'll talk to John Clayton. That's next on Bob, Dave, and More.